Ruth chapter 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. She was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the woman of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived, her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Therefore she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you. As you have dealt with the dead and with me, the Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." So she kissed them. They lifted up their voices and wept, and they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why would you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, and go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. She said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people, to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge, and your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." And when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened when they came to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" But she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess with her, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So here we are looking at a book that's in a very different place in time, actually, than what we've been looking at in the New Testament. Here we have people of Israel actually living in a foreign land. They're living in Moab, and it's the time of the judges. Some of you may not be familiar with the time of the judges, but the time of the judges in the Old Testament is before God gave the Israelites kings, and it was very messy. It was a very dark time. The book of Judges, if you read it, is one of those books that actually upsets people because it's filled with accounts of very sad, difficult, harsh circumstances. It's a time when there's tribal warfare. There's different tribes of Israel even attacking each other and fighting with each other. It's a time where things are unraveling and falling apart, where there's warlords and there's walled cities, and you read of people having to hide their food and run from enemies and all kinds of difficulties. There was no central government in that time. So there was no king. There was no police force that was united or army. There were clans even wiping each other out. There were bizarre and strange religions. And there is the uncomfortable topic even there as Judges unravels towards the end of sexual assault and murder and horrific murder. And so the Bible, by the way, is realistic. These things happen in the world. And it's in the midst of those very dark pictures that the book of Ruth actually comes, outlining the desperate and the hard situations people ended up in, but then also the hope of God's care. The main theme of the book of Judges is a refrain. You know how a song has a refrain? It repeats the same line a few times, the hook or the refrain of the song. Well, the hook or the refrain of Judges is actually in chapter 17, 18, 19, and 21. There's this phrase over and over, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So that's the book of Judges. Everybody's doing whatever they want. They're doing what's right in their own eyes. They're setting up false worship, and they're just living in a mess of taking advantage of one another and stealing and murdering. Everyone does what's right in their own eyes. There's no king. There's no authority. And now, as we come to the book of Ruth, there's been a famine. They've run out of food. Famine in the Old Testament, even to this day, it's a picture often of God's judgment. It's a picture of what happens to a lawless land and to a people that lose touch with doing things God's way. And there you find now this little family. All that's left of it is Naomi, actually, when it comes to Israelites, and then her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Naomi. They're refugees, or she is a refugee in a foreign land. That also, by the way, happened again and again in the Old Testament, that people like Abraham ended up having to run away because of famine. Joseph, and later the people of Israel, ended up being taken out of the land. But here we have now this scene. These three women, and they're arguing on the edge, probably, of a village, about to leave. They're having a debate over what should happen next, and from the language, it's very passionate. You have to imagine them probably weeping and gesturing and debating and disputing what's going to happen next. And really what we're coming on the scene of here is a family breakup. That's what's happening. A family is being broken apart. Well, we're going to look at this first chapter under the theme, Your God, My God, Your God, My God. That's really the heart of Ruth's confession. First, we'll look at a family disaster. Family disaster. Second, a family divided. And third, a determined daughter. So first, there's this family that we're introduced to that's been through this disaster. Their names, by the way, meant something. One of the things about the Old Testament times is that people would give their children names that, not because they liked the sound, which is our custom, but they would give their children names that were a testimony usually to what they believed. And so many Israelites actually that had names that had God in them or Jehovah in them. If you hear all these names that end in Jah, that's usually Jehovah or a short form for that. Or Eli, Elimelech, that's actually the name for God. And it's interesting, Elimelech means my God is king. My God is king. Now think about what we just talked about in Judges. There was no king in Israel. And here you have a man named Elimelech. My God is king. Probably faithful, believing parents. People who thought that God was their king and they wanted to name their son that in observance of that. And the irony here is, if you think of his name and if you could read the original language of it, instead of hearing a strange, funny-sounding name, as the Hebrews would read this, because Elimelech means nothing to us when we hear that sound, what really happened here is God is king left the land. It's kind of sad and ironic testimony. It continues the theme of Judges. There was no king in Israel. Here, God, the king, as it were, has left the land. Now, that doesn't mean that Elimelech himself is God, but that there's an irony to it. And then the name Naomi. Naomi actually means pleasant, pleasant one. And we read the last part of the chapter where she speaks about that pleasant. But here also we have two more names, the boys' names. They're uncertain what they mean, but think of this family, Pleasant, and then My God is King. And they had left the land of Israel behind. They had walked away from it. That's not a good thing, but it seems understandable. It seems that Israel was under judgment. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, God had warned the Israelites that if they left his law behind, if they ignored his commandments, and if they started living by doing whatever they wanted, that one of the things that would happen to Israel is there would be famine. The basket would be empty, God had said in Deuteronomy 28. The kneading bowl would be empty. The sky, he talks about, will turn hard like bronze. The earth, which is under you, shall be like iron. So God gives a picture. If you live in sin and if you ignore my commandments, what's going to happen is the earth's going to dry out. The sky is going to be like hard bronze. Your baskets are going to be empty. And God had told this ahead of them. And he even told them that you're going to end up fleeing the land. And here we see that fulfilled. The land had abandoned the law of God. There had been a famine now. They were fleeing from enemies. You can think of Gideon and others, people having to run from enemies in the book of Judges. And the irony is they've had to run this family from Bethlehem. Bethlehem means house of bread. Bethlehem was supposed to be a place that was quite fertile. It was a town where in the area they harvested wheat and barley and things like that. And it was a place where traditionally people had food. And so here you see this family who comes from a believing line, whose children were named believing names. And they come from a place where there should be bread, and they're fleeing. Everything is upside down. Not only that, they're fleeing to Moab. If you know the history of Israel and Moab, the Moabites in Deuteronomy chapter 23, the Israelites were on their way into the promised land and they asked the Moabites to share some bread and some water with them. And the Moabites said, no, forget it. We're not giving you anything. And so they've gone to a place that historically was not one that would normally share bread. Clearly, this little family were desperate refugees. We hear of refugees in our day, and you have to picture them. They're running from what should have been their homeland, what should have been a good place, should have been a place of bread, and they're going towards Moab, which is bad news. It's not a good direction, and then it gets even worse. This man, we'll call him God is King, just so you remember what his name really means. God is King dies in Moab. Think of how a person would read this. It's a hint, a reminder of what's happening. People's belief and their faith is going downhill to the point where it leads to spiritual death. Now, of course, God never dies. We know that ultimately, but there's a sense here. Everything is unraveling. Everything is falling apart, and God's people are far from him. Is God dead? No, he is certainly not. But from Naomi's words, she feels that God has turned against her. Everything is going wrong. Now, how do we judge this family? They had to flee, undoubtedly. Did they flee in the wrong direction? We don't know for sure how to judge them. I think we should always be careful about judging them. We can say, well, it's kind of obvious they left the promised land. But we should look at our own hearts and examine, what do we do when things get really hard? Do we not have the same inclination? Certainly they go in a bad direction, and certainly there's judgment. But these were people who were also starving. Difficulty. They should have sort of stayed the course ultimately or ideally and stayed in the promised land somehow or other. That's certainly at least implied, but this is a horrific situation. Was their death a judgment? Well, when you see all three of these men, the father and the two sons, dying, when you see them also beyond that, not being given children, before these men die. It is all around a picture of judgment. The whole picture comes together, and it's a sad and it's a hard picture. It's a picture of what does happen when a land, and we don't know how much this family were victims, so to speak. Sometimes the life becomes a mess in hard times. They were perhaps living the best they could according to God's law, and how much this was directly their fault, but clearly they've ended up far from God. They are a picture of walking from his presence. And there's a certain warning in that. Do you walk away from God's presence? What do we do? How do we respond when things get hard? Do we fall to our knees in prayer? Do we get as close as we can to the Lord? Or do we try to find our own ways? Well, this family ends up far away, buried in a foreign land. If you trace through what we call the sort of biblical theology of the Old Testament, being buried in a foreign land, that's not a good picture. Remember that Jacob wanted his bones buried in the promised land back in Genesis. And here he's buried in the wrong place and his sons. It's a dim scene. And as we look at the whole scene, we should be thinking, who is your king? Does God rule your life? At this time in the life of Israel, the problem was people just wouldn't bend their knee to God. They just refused to bow to him and to repent of their sin and to believe in his ways. Are you clinging to your own ways, or are you bending the knee and sticking close to the Lord, or wandering away from him? You know, this picture of wandering away from the Lord that comes up again and again in the Old Testament, that has little to do with geography in our day. It doesn't have much to do with living in the wrong place. Some people think that way, that it mainly has to do with moving to the wrong area or something like that. And it can happen that a prodigal child or something intentionally moves in a bad direction. They move away from accountability intentionally. But really, when you look at our time, when it comes to cell phones and computers, when it comes to the thoughts of our own minds, it's possible to drift away from God just in your own thoughts. It's possible to go to Moab and beyond, even as you sit here, isn't it? To drift away from God's ways, to go your own way, to follow your own heart, to go in your own directions. And you think of how the internet opens doors to this. One thing we have to realize is this is not so much about living in one place anymore. The danger is all these foreign things now in our day, they can come right into your home, right into your mind. They can work their way, and we can end up living in a foreign land, and a covenant child can, even as they live at home. What a danger there is. And so the thing to consider is, as we see this family moving away from the promised land, is, are you staying close to the Lord? Are you staying close to his church? Are you staying close to his people? Well, the story actually gets worse from an Israelite perspective. The boys marry Moabite women. Now, there was no law directly against that in the Old Testament. There was laws against marrying Canaanites. They were not allowed to do that at all. But the thing was, is a Moabite was not allowed in the tabernacle, or later the temple. These boys were marrying foreign women. They were marrying women that were under a certain judgment of God. Their names, Ruth and Orpah, to a Hebrew, those sounds like very strange names, unusual names from actually a related but a different language, a different dialect, maybe you could say. And the picture is here, this family is settling in. They're settling in for the long haul. What happens when boys marry foreign women? What would you expect to happen? They'd settle down, of course. Chances are they'd live out their lives in that land, and they'd never come back to the promised land. That's often what happens, isn't it? When somebody marries outside the church, or they marry in a different country, they usually end up settling down on the outside. And so it's a sign that this family has given up and they're settling down. And then God's judgments continue. They're childless. The boys die. And we end up with a pretty extreme situation. 3 widows. But think about this for a moment. What if things went well in Moab? What if Elimelech started a business, got into something or other, and he did quite well and he lived a long life? What if the boys survived and did quite well? What would happen? They'd probably stay there, wouldn't they? They'd get entrenched. They'd settle down. Why would they move back? Why would they want to ever move back? And God's providences may seem harsh and difficult here. And they certainly did to Naomi, and she recognized the hand of God going out against her. But the Lord God is actually working in his providences to bring these prodigals back, to bring this family line back, who the Father loves, he chastens. He puts Naomi in a place where there's no choice but to head back. She has nothing left in Moab, nothing left in the wrong place. And if the Lord takes us to that point where nothing in this world keeps us here, so to speak, where we have no choice but to flee to him and to run to him and to return to him, kind of like that prodigal son in the New Testament. Remember, he just ends up living in a pig pen and he has nothing left. And he says, it's better to be a servant in my father's house. And finally, he comes to his senses. Well, that similar thing is happening to Naomi. And there's something implied happening here that we don't realize or see right away. But the Hebrew audience probably would. The great peril that's happening to this family and them getting narrowed down to just widows is horrific because this is the line of Judah. These are the sons of Judah who is going to be the prophesied ruler. And that means the hope of a seed and a deliverer is in peril. It's down to almost nothing that God will raise up a deliverer. And God has taken his people mercifully to the point where they have nothing left but the hope that he will deliver them. It's all judgment here. There's hunger and there's exile and there's death and there's intermarriage and there's childlessness. And this family's tried an escape route, but it's just gone worse and worse. And that's the story of the Old Testament, that God's people end up stuck with no resources left to help themselves. Nothing left but to admit failure and to go back towards the Lord. Now, it'd be better to admit this before we hit rock bottom. But the good news is that even for those that hit rock bottom and seem to run out of options and see everything in this life sort of falling apart, the good news is that there's still hope to come back to the Lord. And Naomi, even though she's bitter, and even though she's wrestling and struggling, these footsteps she's taking are the best steps of her life. Her heart's not really in it yet. She hasn't seen the blessing in it yet. And she's cynical and dark. And yet she's turning the right direction. And doesn't that often happen also with God's people? There's hard circumstances, there's cynicism, and sometimes the mind has to lead the heart, which is still bitter. But the good news is she's heading home. But as she heads home, now there's a new crisis in the family. A new crisis. The problem is what will her daughters-in-law do? For them to go along towards Israel just doesn't seem to make sense. Who's going to marry foreign women? Here they would go as widows and as foreigners. And Naomi tells them to do the practical thing. It's hard for us to understand just how difficult it was for a widow in those days. There was no social safety net. There was no cooperative housing. There was little for them to find for help. And so what actually happened with women in those days is they were basically adopted by their family. And they even had a system of what was called levirate marriage. And that's in the background throughout the book of Ruth. And what the system was when you married into a family as a woman, you married into that family unit. And you became part of it for life. And they took care of you no matter what. So even if your husband died, your husband's family had to take care of you. Now that might sound strange because it even led to the point of getting married to your brother-in-law. That might sound strange, but you have to think of a time where there's a lack of men to go around. Men are dying in war. It's difficult. It's a harsh land and a harsh world. And the way for widows to survive was to be assigned to a family unit to have not just a husband, but then also brothers-in-law and a father-in-law and hopefully sons to look out for them. Because there's no other way. It's not like there's a welfare system. It's not like there's child support payments or something like that. And so they stuck with their family. And what's happening here is horrific because when you have three widows with no men to take care of them, to go hunting and to work the ground and to do all of the things necessary to protect and to fight off enemies and wild beasts, that's desperate. That's difficult. That's hard. And what Naomi is proposing is basically a divorce. That's the closest thing we could think of it. Or sending away an adopted child. It's a family breakup. And it makes sense on the practical or what we'd call the pragmatic level. Go return each to your mother's house. And she's not going to be able to raise up. You understand that she's thinking the only way for her to provide husbands for these women if she herself had more children. That just doesn't seem possible. She's too old. And she looks at the whole situation and she takes the most practical and the reasonable way out. You go home, go back to your families. Hopefully they can find Moabite husbands. She can't provide. She's a widow. She's convinced, by the way, that the hand of God has gone against her. She's cursed. What's the point? And she says, just go home. And it makes sense practically. What future is them for them in Israel? And what Orpah does makes total sense, humanly. Go back to her parents' place, go back to her old religion, go back to the people who spoke the same language as her, go back to the same customs. Here, this family situation is too complicated. It's irreconcilable. Better to just move on. And what she does, you would think, would make sense. Why would a Moabite woman with no hope follow a widow across a wilderness back to a foreign country where there's a stigma against getting married to foreigners? And so Orpah goes the conventional way. The normal way. And she fades away into history. She disappears. You never hear about her again. Seems like she's making the wise decision, but she's not. And that's usually the way it is, often the way it is with family breakups. People think there's irreconcilable differences. People think it's just too hard to deal with. And so they split and things break apart in families. And it looks like the best way, practically, people think. But what's at issue here is, will they keep covenant? We don't have a great grasp on the idea of covenant. Sometimes we still call a marriage a covenant. But you have to understand that there was a covenant between these three women, that they were supposed to be committed to each other. They were supposed to be a family unit for life. And that covenant was supposed to stick no matter what. No matter how bad things got, you're supposed to keep your promises. And a marriage promise in those days included sticking with your family. No matter what. And Orpah here is actually a covenant breaker. She's actually walking away from covenant. She should have stayed. And Ruth, somehow, maybe in a cloudy and an uncertain way yet, she simply cannot and will not break covenant. She will not walk away. She will not go that way. She is absolutely committed. We need to be those that keep our covenants, keep our promises, no matter what. And sometimes that means soldiering on and continuing on through some of the hardest and the most difficult and the most hopeless circumstances, because that's what this is. This is Ruth sticking with a mother-in-law who's bitter. Now think about this. The picture is actually almost humorous in a way, if you think of the stereotypes of mother-in-laws. Imagine sticking across a wilderness journey with the most bitter of mother-in-laws, who's in the hardest and the most difficult situation, and whose language throughout the book is dark and cynical and nasty, and who's now basically saying, go home, get away from me. There's almost a sense of leave me alone, and Ruth still sticks with her. And she's still going to walk, and she's still going to journey. And as Christians, we are often called in our relationships to the same kind of testimony, to stick with difficult people, to stick with believers or others or family members who are bitter or going through a harsh time, and not to follow our own heart. You know that Orpah's going back to the land of the god Chemosh. She's going back to the land of false gods. She's going back to the land of, if you want to study up on it, is Balaam and Balak. You read about that in the New Testament and Old. To a land of idolatry and wickedness. And Ruth here is taking a wilderness journey towards God. And we'll just quickly look at her decision finally, contrasting Ruth. Well, Naomi is in this place of leave me alone in my misery. Ruth is like, sort of seems just like a puppy that won't go home. She just clings and clings to Naomi. And she gives this speech. The speech of Ruth, some of the most beautiful and determined words ever spoken. And you'll notice in many Bibles, they're set out as poetry in verses 16 and following, that speech she gives, it's more beautiful than anything Shakespeare wrote. It's more memorable. I'm guessing some of you remember some of the words from that speech just from reading them a few times. They're so powerful. And try to picture the scene. Moab was to the east of Israel. Between them and Bethlehem is a dry desert. Naomi is heading out probably of a village or a town or an encampment. And there's an unknown ahead of them, and there's a familiarity behind them. And now Ruth, even though the language and the family and the customs and the village or the tents behind them are familiar, she gives this speech, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. It's absolute determination. She's going to go all the way, even if it kills her. She's going to keep covenant. She's going to stay with her family. She's going to stay with her mother-in-law. She's going to travel with her, live with her. She's going to join her people. She's going to follow her God. She's going to die, and she's going to be buried, and she becomes actually a contrast with Elimelech. What happens in the Old Testament is there's a series of foreign women who actually put God's people to shame. You can think of Tamar, you can think of Rahab, and you can think of Ruth. And there's actually this string of women who are in the lineage of Jesus Christ and who are mothers of Jesus Christ. And if you think about Ruth and Elimelech, Elimelech is an Israelite who went in the wrong direction and ended up buried in Moab. And Ruth's testimony is that she's a Gentile, a Moabite, a foreigner, who is confessing, I will go in the right direction, I will go to the promised land, and I'm going to make your God my God, and I will be buried there. I will go west. He broke with Israel, she breaks with Moab. And they go in opposite directions, and her words even become a prophecy. So if you trace through her words, what she says she will do in determination, God makes that happen in her life. and even far better. And so a Moabite woman has more faith, more determination than the best of Israelite families. And that's how the story of the scriptures often plays out. By the way, as women, God has given you a different role in this world than men. And the world seems to think and claim that being powerful and being at the forefront is what saves. But God again and again uses women in the scriptures, and he uses them in their places and in their times to show this beautiful and this bright faith that shines forth. And the women of the church today need to take confidence and realize that God powerfully uses your faith and your testimony even to change the world. Don't think that changing the world necessarily means being a CEO. If you're called to be a CEO or a president, well, good for you. But God also uses the little people and the most insignificant seeming people often for his grand and his great purposes. Ruth also, by the way, throws Naomi's words back in her face. I don't think it's in a rude way, but Naomi had said, "Your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." And Ruth is actually taking that, turning it around completely, and going the other way. Well, here we see Ruth walking by faith and not sight. She becomes an example of those who trust in the Lord against all odds. She is one of those pilgrims we've been looking at in Hebrews in the afternoon. They sought a continuing city. They declared plainly that they seek a homeland. And so she is going the way of the Lord. A most unlikely pilgrim, but a pilgrim whose faith begins to shine brightly and who the Lord will care for. Amen. Let us pray.